The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 20th, 2009, and this is episode number 165, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here, as always, to sort of lead you into this conversation that Jules and I have. So, got a big, big show today. Jules and I did a very, very long call about some rule changes that came down, mandated by the FIM, and which is effectively mouthpiece for Dorna, and all of that sort of thing. And we talk about stuff, each of the rule changes in somewhat semi-detail, going step by step. It was an interesting call. We had a lot of fun doing it. I got to tell you that part of the process of MotoGP OD is that I do edit the calls. I cut out some of the stuff where we digress. I cut out the parts where I'm opening a beer, that kind of thing. But one of the things that I sort of cut out of this call was some area of confusion where Jules and I were discussing what is ceramic brakes versus carbon brakes. And we sort of came to the conclusion during the call that it meant the same thing. And unfortunately, now I've read some more information that it may not be the same thing. I'm still a little vague, to be 100% honest, but I'm going to leave the edit as it is, which in the call it means that I am assuming that, MotoGP is banning carbon brakes for 2009. Now, I want you to just listen carefully because I thought that I raised some very interesting points because it was very erudite and all that good stuff. And just listen to it. However, there's a link that I'm going to put up to Kropotkin's blog at MotoGPMatters.com, which is an excellent blog, and you should definitely subscribe to it and make sure you read it, which I don't do often enough because, unfortunately, I just don't seem to have the time anymore. But whatever. I'm going to put that link up there, and he talks about it, and we talk a bit about it, and just sort of forgive me if I am technically wrong on what we're talking about here. It is all my bad. Jules suggested that I sort of cut it out, but I'm going to leave what I left in there. Okay. So that said, we're going to get to that in just half a second. Before we do that, I want to mention again, Adam Kress's cool calendar for MotoGP, which you can subscribe to with any, it's the iCal format, the .ics, whatever, Google calendar, all sorts of different things support this calendar. Go to Adam Kress's webpage. I'm going to put a link up there, of course, and you can download or subscribe to the calendar for all sorts of different racing series. It's going to tell you what's coming up and everything, so you know when to watch out for the races. Now, this is not the TV schedule. This is the actual race schedule. The TV schedule might be very different, but if you know that a MotoGP race is going to be this weekend, then you probably should look on Speed TV for the MotoGP coverage. That sort of thing, like I'm talking about. Adam's covering all sorts of things. He also has, and we announced this last week, we're going to give away quite a few licenses, 10 licenses, for his Fast App application. And this application is for the iPhone and the iPod Touch, anything that can basically do an App Store application. And the Fast App application, it gives you the live timing from MotoGP.com during the race. So rather than having to have all this nasty flash and your laptop sitting on your lap and this and that and the other, what you could do is you could have your laptop going, watching the race on MotoGP.com because you paid for a subscription at MotoGP.com, and that's a good thing. Watching the race live at, you know, some very early time in the morning if you happen to live on the West Coast of the United States, but whatever time it is for you locally, watch the race and have your iPhone / iPod Touch doing the live timing, so you're not switching back and forth between windows. You don't have to deal with quite as much flash, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really, really cool thing. And to be honest, it's probably because we don't have enough listeners that meet the criteria, but I haven't had as much response to this contest as I've had to the others. So I want you to send me, if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch and you live in the United States, send me your email address. We're going to have a drawing for these 10 licenses for Adam Kress's Fast App application from the App Store. It's a really, really cool thing. Send it in. We have gotten more than enough to give away the 10, but we haven't gotten quite up to the usual numbers. And I'm just kind of curious about that. Basically, running, boiling down to how many of you guys out there have iPhones or iPod touches, you know, anything that can do an App Store app. Like Joel said, he has a BlackBerry, so he's a little bit left out in the cold on this one. I do see the iPhones coming in on the internet. I'm just kind of curious. It's not anything bad. Okay, that said, let's see. Other front matter, don't have a whole lot going on. As usual, lately, got behind on my email. If you sent me an email and you did not hear back from me or Jules or anything, apologize. I think we caught up on all of them, but sometimes they come in floods, and it's just, you know, hey, you know, we have regular day jobs too, and sometimes you just don't have time. So I do apologize if we did not reply to your email. They are all valuable, and I do read them all. It's just that sometimes I say, oh, I'll reply to this one later, and then it sort of never gets done. Okay, I think that's enough of babbling for now. So one more time, if you got an iPhone or an iPod Touch, send an email to contest164@motogpod.com, and we will have a drawing for 10 licenses, one of 10 licenses for Adam Kress's Fast App application. That will be on the next show, which is on February 27th, episode number 166. We're going to announce those winners. And other than that, why don't we get to the call with Jules? Oh, and one more thing. Make sure you check out the MotoGPMatters.com link that I'm going to put up on the website. Go to MotoGPMatters if you don't want to take notes and all that. MotoGPMatters, the blog post you want to read is "Those No MotoGP Rules, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly." And it was posted on Thursday the 19th at about midnight, which I'm not sure if that's my local time or his time or whatever, but MotoGP Matters. You'll find the blog post, and of course, there'll be a direct link on MotoGPOD.com. All right, enough babbling on. Here's me and Jules. All right. Hey, Jules, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good, good. Having a busy, busy week at work again, still, whatever, continuing. But that's good, because a lot of people are not, which I think we mentioned last week. And speaking of busy, kind of fun stuff happening in MotoGP this week. And we've got World Supers coming up here in, 10 days? Something like that?
Yep.
So, yeah, that's kind of cool.
And there's been some testing in Australia. Aprilia and Kawasaki Ducati was out there. A lot of familiar faces, Nakano, Biaggi, and West kind of leading the field the last couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. So it is. You know, season's coming around pretty much just around the corner. Still have, you know, more than a month for MotoGP, but at least, you know, the World Supers, that's always good stuff. And basically, spring is arriving.
Yeah.
Always awesome. But we did have, there's some interesting news in MotoGP we should talk about since we kind of wrapped up our season finale, which was great for the four shows, you know, gave us a lot to talk about. So, which was just as well because news was a little dry.
And now, all the talk and rumors and we've heard for like the last 3 or 4 months have now been solidified because there were announcements made today about the rule changes for this year and for 2010. And then also we should probably do a little bit of a segment on Valentino Rossi turned 30 on Monday.
The ripe old age of 30.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And there was some funny stuff that happened around that. So
yeah, that's just kind of, I mean, the rule changes is significant, and I don't know, it seems kind of late in the game also for them to be casting down these kind of, you know, edicts from on high.
Well, that's actually my main objection to the technical changes. I think that, so the list of changes is basically that the morning Friday practice is no longer, it's canceled completely. And then all the practices are now 45 minutes for MotoGP, 45 minutes for 250s, and 40 minutes for the 125s. There's only one QP now for 125s and 250s. Remember, they used to have that old school two-stage qualifying.
Right.
Now it's just two practice and then a qualifying, just like MotoGP. And then almost all the testing is banned, basically, except for 2 weekends when only test riders are allowed to test.
Okay.
That's after Catalunya and Brno.
Yeah. So let's talk real quick before we get into the rest of the rule changes. Let's cover this real quick, the qualifying and the scrapping of the Friday practices, because there was actually a write-up in Cycle News. I believe it was Michael Scott, if memory serves me correctly, one of his editorials on the back page, which is excellent stuff. And this is ostensibly to cut costs, and in some ways it will cut costs, particularly if they can sort of reduce the wear and tear on the engines and this and that sort of thing, and number of tires used and all of that.
Yeah.
But the other point, the other flip side to it, is that it reduces the overall show benefit for the fans, right? You're seeing that much less on-track action. Maybe they're going to have some filler or what have you, but it's taking something away from the value of that ticket that you purchased. And I don't know. I'm not 100% sure, and I don't know what you think. And I also think immediately the first thing I thought when we saw 125s get 40 minutes as opposed to the 250s and the MotoGP guys getting 45 minutes. Granted, this is only 5 minutes, but it's still it's a shortening. And aren't the 125 guys? These are the youngest guys,
Those guys always had shorter sessions.
Yeah,
they always did. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The practice sessions were always shorter. The qualifying was always shorter.
I thought they were getting an hour.
They were definitely shorter always, and the races are shorter, so it's like...
The
races are actually shorter time-wise, not just because they're slow and they do less laps. They're actually
right, fewer laps, shorter. Fewer kilometers. Yeah.
So I think that's the balance has remained the same. I think that the big issue here... So I think there's definitely... This is a nice way to kind of cut costs... I think it's a drop in the bucket, but I think that the people who suffer are the guys who are still developing their bikes. In other words, this is great for Ducati, it's great for Honda, and it's great for Yamaha because those guys in MotoGP because those guys have very well developed bikes that are winning races. Suzuki needs that extra time and needs those extra practice sessions. Because they're still developing their bike to be competitive, so I think they're getting screwed.
Yeah, I agree. And I so many of the times, and we'll get into more of this later, but these ideas to cut costs, yeah, you're, like you said, a drop in the bucket. And granted, you know, a few drops start adding up.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But it, I don't know. Is it really?
I mean,
does it make
that much
difference? The
decision was made with the manufacturers and. And the FIM and Dorna, so that's pretty good actually. That you know all those organizations were involved, but I think that the manufacturers are, you know, their opinions are very skewed towards what Honda and Yamaha and Ducati now probably say. I mean, Ducati has to be extremely influential now because they're supplying 5 bikes for the grid. I mean, Dorna is going to bend over backwards for them.
Yeah, I think that's true. Not even getting into the fact of the Italian. You know, a European manufacturer all of that. And, you know, Casey Stoner champion last year, previous year, and all of that. I don't know. So many of these things are a little bit, like I said, it's almost like the Kawasaki pulling out of MotoGP as far as the grand scheme of their company, where it's largely symbolic.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And I think they actually reverted some of those, like we discussed last show, I think some of the money that was being poured into MotoGP from Kawasaki is now going to go into AMA and World Superbike and Super Sport actually also.
Well, I think Kawasaki sees a more direct benefit from those dollars
as far as advertising
dollars.
Oh yeah. It totally makes
sense. They sell more bikes based on their superbike performance.
One thing that I don't agree with critics of the cut time is like I don't agree that this is going to hurt the sponsors. Like, this is actually because all the sessions are shorter. I think somebody on either David Emmett or one of the comments on the Kropotkin Thinks blog, MotoGP Matters. I'll never stop calling it Kropotkin Thinks. Somebody on there said that it's basically like 33% less coverage. Therefore, you know, sponsors might get unhappy. But, like, I really doubt – I mean, I think that you have to multiply those times by, like, race time. Race equals time times 100, you know, qualify equals race time. I mean, time times, like, 50 or 20. And then, you know, free practice, I mean, very few people even are able to watch it on TV. In Europe, of course they can, but
on when Eurosport was around, not necessarily always
true.
Now that it's...
Yeah, we don't know that. That's true. That's true.
Yeah, because BBC didn't used to always run those. I think every now and then they put one in when there wasn't something else going or something like that, but it was never a regularly scheduled thing.
No,
I don't know about the German and French and Spanish, you know, those terrestrial stations, but Spain, they probably would be more likely, maybe Italy as well, but... that'd be interesting to find out. So anyone who's listening out there that knows this stuff, maybe give us a shout. But, yeah, I don't think you're going to see free practice on TV much anywhere in the world anymore.
Yeah, so I don't think the sponsors are getting hurt by this all that much. So I don't think that's an issue. I think that the big issue is that the guys who actually need development time are getting screwed.
Yeah. I think that does make a certain sense, and that will snowball to the sponsors that you know, say like Rizla, you know, is getting that much less exposure because Suzuki sucks that much more, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, as far as I know, there is no Rizla anymore.
Well, you know, Suzuki, what I mean, you know that those sponsors.
So that's the first major rule change. The second important rule is the you know, after the summer break. Once we go to Brno, for the rest of the season, they're only allowed to use 5 engines.
Right, for the remaining 8 races.
Per motorcycle. Right. Actually, you know, it doesn't say here in the official release, but I'm guessing that's per motorcycle, not per...
It's got to be. And it does say the riders will only have 5 engines to use for the remaining 8 races, not the team. So,
but does that mean you have to, I mean, we have 2 bikes.
Oh, yeah, duh. I see what you're saying. You know, that's actually a really good question.
Yeah.
And that one is, yeah, that might be better, more clarity on that one.
Yep.
Huh. Now, though, that brings up a point. I mean, like, most, if not all, of these motorcycles, I know Honda does it, and I think some of the other guys do it. Basically, after each race weekend, this bike is crated up and shipped back to the factory for a complete rebuild at hideous expense, right?
Right, right.
But they don't send back both engines from, you know, both bikes, do you think? I mean, because many weekends, unless a rider has a serious enough crash to have to bring out the B bike, they might work almost exclusively on their A bike.
Yeah, and as we know, like, very often when, you know, at warm-up time, Nicky Hayden got crashing at Valencia, all of a sudden he's stuck with his number 2 bike, which they didn't do anything on. It was just sitting there.
Right. But, I mean, even if they try to match the settings and stuff, these bikes are prototypes and everything, and it's always something is – and for these riders, there's so much on the edge that tiny little differences that, you know, mere mortals would never, ever notice the difference. For these guys, it does make a difference. And so, yeah, there's always problems when a guy has to switch to his B-bike at the last minute. It's never a really good thing. So I kind of doubt that they've been, like, rebuilding 2 engines – every weekend anyway.
No. I mean, but you remember Suzuki, like, remember that one weekend in 2005 when they had, like, 13 engines?
It was something crazy. 13, I think it was,
yeah.
So if they only have 5 engines to use for the remaining 8 races this season, that's a little bit like the Formula One rule where they basically say this engine has to last 2 races.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know the details of how that works. Well, they don't have second cars in Formula One, though. Do they? I think they have – the team has 1 spare car, something like that.
Right. I don't know, actually.
It used to be that way. I'm not sure if it is now or what. But, yeah, whatever. Not a Formula 1 show.
I'm a big fan of the 1 bike per rider rule, which is going to happen in 2010, sounds like. They're going to have to get rid of the flag-to-flag rule because that's going to make racing way too dangerous. Basically, if you have – if you have a situation where it starts to rain and the rain and the thing is declared wet and then you have to go into the pit and actually change wheels, you know, riders are going to end up staying out a lot longer than they should be, which means they're going to be taking risks and somebody's going to end up getting hurt. So I think we have to, if we're going to go to the 1 bike rule, I think we have to go back also to the red flag and then a sprint race, and hopefully they will go back to the aggregate, which is, you know, classic, and we've only got rid of it. We only got rid of it, like, you know, in the last 8 years. Yeah. Before that, people were able to, I mean, the fans were able to deal with it. I think in the sport moved more to TV, the TV audience grew and grew and grew, and it grew to more than just like real racing aficionados. I can understand why they wanted to make the racing more simple. But right. if they're going to go to this single bike thing, I think they really need to make a complete revision of how rain stuff works.
Yeah.
And the sprint race is is dangerous too, I think.
Yeah, it tends to be. And I think an aggregate would be probably safer than and also I think it's more meaningful, but it's less clear on television.
I know. So that's the thing is you kind of have to like they have to give up something. I mean, I think it's a good it's a decent idea because it's classic. I mean, like you don't Agostini did not have multiple bikes sitting next to him. You know, during race weekend, you know, they'd be building up a crashed bike, you know, they might have parts enough to build another bike, but they'd be building it over that weekend. So
yeah.
it's only like, you know, in the last 15, 20 years that we started having like multiple bikes per rider.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting point. Cause I was going to object that, you know, the backup bike, is, you know, important, et cetera, but there's no doubt that it would save money. That one you would clearly save, I think, a substantial amount of money.
So it's substantial, but there was I did want to mention kind of like the devil's advocate version, which is, you know, the real cost of a MotoGP bike is not the parts and the labor of putting it together. It's the R&D, right?
Oh, yeah.
You only do that once.
I
mean,
right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's constantly in development, but both bikes are being upgraded at the same time. So I think that it's a substantial cut in cost, and I think it'd be more meaningful than some of these other rules that they mentioned so far.
Yeah,
but I
another
think
another area though that was suggested as cutting costs and actually would cut a fair amount of money is sort of smartening up, if you want to call it that, the flyaway race schedule, because you know we tend to have but Dorna won't have any of that. Oh no!
Because they want to have a weekend. They want to have a race weekend in Europe at least every other, you know,
exactly
race.
Because exactly. Because it's still a European sport,
right?
For all intents and purposes, and they don't want to have these guys just disappearing for four or five races all at a stretch,
right?
You know that often. So
which actually you're right. That's a big saving cost. I mean, I can't even imagine what it costs to fly out to California, then fly back, then fly out to Indianapolis, fly back, then Japan. Well, Japan, Australia, Sepang.
Yeah, usually, they did the stretch, the three-race stretch. Japan, Australia, Malaysia, right?
Yep.
Typically.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we had China, which is now off the calendar anyway.
No, but the two U.S. rounds should definitely be side by side. I mean, why not?
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
We could all just take a, like, you know, 2 week vacation and drive
follow
from
them around
from
like groupies and stuff.
Sick. Yeah. I know that a lot of like one of the things we talked about last week about the Hungarian round, and you know, and then there was a suggestion of Portimao. Becoming a MotoGP track, but the Hungarian round was so close to the Portuguese race. And I was thinking, so what? Isn't that like a kind of a good thing? Like you can, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I guess they want to separate the races out in one region so that they can get as much variety, because maybe people won't go to two in a row or something.
It might be part of that they're trying to help the venues keep attendance up, because I think the venues benefit most from on-track attendance.
Of course.
Not sure what like Dorna's cut of the gate is. I'm sure they get a substantial cut, but you know, it's in the venue's best interest for attendance. And you're right, you know, okay, two races in Portugal back to back. Yeah, you're probably going to lose a lot of that two race audience, you know what I'm saying? The hardcore fans would love it, like you know, like you just said, that we'll just take 2 weeks off work and all of that. Right, but the less hardcore fans, or the guys that are, you know, maybe not quite in such a that position, you know, as far as work is concerned, and or whatever reason,
dude, they're in Europe. You're gonna... They get like 6 to 8 weeks vacation. Come on,
you're right, with all kinds of pay, extra pay, because you need money when you're on vacation. Yeah, yeah. but you know, you get my point, yeah. And I think that that might be something that is bearing on that. I do think, though, that the flyaway races to Asia, that they could, that would be an area to save money. And that, you know, but since it's not something that Dorna likes, you know, it's like, oh, no, can't do that.
Right.
So the five of eight and five races, five engines for eight races. Boy, spit that one out. That is interesting if it's per bike. I would...
It may be total. It may be total. That would make sense.
I'm only reading Kropotkin's thing.
Let me ask you this though. How do you enforce this?
Oh, they seal
what,
it. And stuff.
What does rebuilding an engine actually mean? What can you do?
I think it means taking the heads off. It depends. If they do it like Formula One, they have like you know, those little lead crimp-on seals.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as they break that seal for whatever reason, then you're done. I believe.
I mean, I know that's been solved. I'm just saying that like the culture in the MotoGP paddock seems to be pretty free flowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, people
walking in and out of garages and shit like that. So, I mean, you know, maybe somebody could sneak in there and break a competitor's seal. You know,
Oh wow, that would be awful. Yeah. If it is that simple, and I'm making a bit of an assumption, but I seem to remember hearing that on the Formula One side. And I think that also Dorna and the MSMA and FIM and all that are following the lead of Formula One. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, say, oh, they've got these rules, we can try that. So they'll tend to do whatever they do, and if that is what they're doing. Where simply you basically put a, you know, what is that called? It's just called a seal, right? You know, when you have that little lead crimper thing.
Yeah.
That's what they'll do, because it's pretty straightforward. You could use zip ties. That would cut costs for MotoGP. instead of all that lead and all that business, you know, you just use a little zip tie and then you color it with a Sharpie or sign it. You know, Carmelo comes over and then signs it.
Right.
And but whatever they do. I think it means basically you take this whole engine and you probably, I'm sure you got to be able to change the oil and stuff like that. Yeah, but
adjust valves and stuff like that.
I don't know.
No, I'm sure you can. That's a really good question. I'm sure you can do that kind of stuff. I'm sure you can do adjustments on
adjustments. Like, yes. On input, I would be surprised if you can't do the adjustments. Yeah.
Ports I mean.
It's a slippery slope. You start talking about ports. It's just like, well, let's give it a polish, you know?
Inside and out, yeah. What about transmission, for example? I mean, you have different gear ratios for these different tracks.
Right, and especially on a motorcycle, the transmission is not the clear-cut, you know, engine, transmission, drivetrain-y sort of thing like a car.
Right.
You know, transmissions tend to be, even though they're all cassette transmissions in the MotoGP world, so you can change the gear ratios very quickly and easily. Yep. It's still kind of integral to the engine, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So that's a good question too. We need to find the actual rules, or is this just now at the press release stage where they don't have the real rules?
I think the rules, I'm sure, have been released to the teams and stuff. I don't think they're on the web basically yet. So
yeah,
I'm sure we'll see them soon.
Oh, I'm sure AMA rules are just like that too. You know, they've all the teams all know exactly what the hell's going on.
right. So if I find anything out tomorrow before you actually put this thing in the can, maybe we'll find the link.
Yeah. Let's take a look. We will. We'll do that. Take a look, and I can talk about it in the intro that has already happened. If you're listening to the show, but of course, in reality, we are recording this call Thursday night.
That's weird.
Wednesday night.
Yeah.
In the Wayback Machine, but let's see what else.
But
we got
general, I do like this direction. You know, like making the thing last, making it less, a little bit less of a money burner. So there's some efficiency. You know, I like the idea of efficiency, but I'm going to bring this up later where it starts to really fall apart.
Yeah, I agree. And now also, look, if we start talking about how do you make engines last longer, the quick, easy answer is reduce the revs. And that means that you reduce the speed. And so many of these other rule changes, and this was actually brought up, this is not my completely original thought, but this was also brought up in that Michael Scott column, that, you know, the whole thing has been about the safety. And this, you know, we got to reduce the speed of the motorcycles because it's so unsafe. And you know, they come up with these artificial sort of things. And like the whole change from the 990s down to the 800s didn't reduce this, the corner speeds at all. And in fact, they increased. And
as we were talking last time, every single record was beaten last week from the 990 era, you know.
And now, I mean, reducing the revs in order to maintain engine life is certainly going to help and, help the engine life. And it is certainly also going to reduce that top speed to an extent. But then I think you're going to get a bit of a trade-off where manufacturers will think that, you know, they're the manufacturers that have the money to throw at the problem to make an engine that can rev to whatever the limit is now, which off the top of my head, I can't remember.
19 et cetera. And a half or whatever.
Yeah, something in that range. Crazy. You know, so they're going to throw more money at it. So you've defeated the purpose of the saving the money because they're spending more money.
So, I mean, all of these things, all of the technical changes, I think fall into the same kind of slippery slope argument. So let's actually cover all of them because then we can talk about it all in one big lump.
Next one.
So ceramic composite materials are not permitted for brakes, disc, or pads, which is great, I think. That's like one area. Like we just don't need ceramic composite brakes. You know, it's like they have one use only in a closed circuit race track. So
that would be a safety thing by far, because the carbon brakes work better.
Well, they work better in certain conditions. Remember, that's the big issue here is that going from wet to dry, you have to use different brakes.
Yeah, but aren't the brakes that they use in the wet, when they break out the iron or steel rotors, and the pretty much normal Joe Blow brake pads, right? I don't think they're going to go to that all the time. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, to be honest with you.
They're going to go bad?
What's that?
That they're going to go bad?
Bad. No. Just that if they went like expire or something.
I think the idea is that you have the same, pretty much the same setup for
wet or dry.
Wet or dry, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, this is something where the coverage that we get of MotoGP is, you know, is so much sort of less than the coverage we can get for Formula One. You know, so the stories that they might do in a Formula One magazine, because there's so much coverage, they'll go down to weird, fine details. And I remember several years ago reading an article about in Formula One, and they were talking about the cost of a set of brakes. And it was like $10,000 a disc. And this, you know, these discs will only last one race and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that one, yeah, that would save costs. On the other hand, like my original point back here was that this is also, I think, an area where you could say that it's a safety thing. If you force these riders to go to regular old iron brakes on a dry circuit, they're not going to have the same stopping power, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
They're going to start slowing down earlier, and, you know, that might be a good thing.
It might be, according to the whole speed kills theory.
Right.
But it might also mean that more people overcook it into the corners.
No, I think these guys, you know, will adjust very quickly. A couple of Lorenzo, you know, high sides, and we'll be done with that.
Right, but well, I don't know. Regular brakes get less effective as they get hot. Carbon brakes get more effective as they get hot.
True.
So, I don't know. I'm skeptical about that one. I wish I had more information.
We've had very fast motorcycles racing with non-carbon brakes before, and you know, and it's been okay.
When?
You know, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, they weren't very fast, and the tires sucked. There was other things that that took care of the the problem. It was now you're going to have an engine that's capable of propelling this motorcycle at 210 miles an hour, and brakes that are designed to stop it from 170 miles an hour.
Well,
don't you see? Am I wrong?
Yeah,
here?
I think you're making a good point, but I think that the whole idea is of slowing down the motorcycle, because that's also going to prevent the manufacturers from trying to gain speed in other ways where they're getting limited in some ways. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
I'm kind of jumping ahead into like what I really want to talk about, like where the costs are not being saved. But mm-hmm. So let's hit a couple more.
Yeah, we're kind of going down this road, and I'm dragging you down this brake path, so to speak. But
brake pad path.
I think it's interesting. I'm going to do some more research on this, and we'll talk about this one again, Jules.
All right. we'll go back to this. We'll go back. So let's just finish this list.
I think it's going to be a topic of conversation for a while. Did we mention the ban on electronic suspension yet?
No, that was actually the fifth one. Thanks a lot, Bob. So.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know you had a specific order.
I'm just going in the same order that they did. Okay. Yeah. So electronic control suspension is not permitted, which I think Yamaha definitely had, and I think Ducati
was Honda experimenting with it. I think Honda might have used it, if I recall correctly, but I'm not 100% sure.
I think Ducati was experimenting with it as well.
Were they? I don't see that one as being. To me, my simple, all overly technical, and not coming up with a great argument for it, that one's probably okay. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, except that I have a feeling. Let's go to the next one. The last one is launch control systems.
Right.
So
this is
one that, like, you know, I'm not sure if it's going to really save costs, because I can't imagine launch control systems being very expensive. I think the biggest problem, of course, is that how do you define a launch control system?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
it's a very slippery slope of exactly what does, and it's hard to enforce without a control ECU.
Isn't the clutch kind of like a mechanism for launch control?
Sure, the rider's hand is a launch control system, right?
Well,
but yeah, you're right. But you know what? Obviously, what they mean is something that detects wheel spin and does something to, you know, prevent it,
right?
Electronically,
right.
But you're right. There's so many
ways to achieve that. Are you going to basically force all the riders to spin their tires to show that they don't have launch control?
Because that would be good for the show. That makes up for that lost free practice. more smoky burnouts. Exactly. That one, you know, I think that one is a bit of a, we've seen it in other sports and
it doesn't
with,
work.
You know, with traction control, launch control, all those different things that you want to call it, that it is, it's very difficult to truly define exactly what's going on and what they're enforcing, because they're all using a proprietary engine control unit. This thing could be doing all sorts of tiny little things that are very, very difficult, if not impossible, to detect.
Right.
In effect, this is causing the factories to spend more money.
Yeah,
in order to cheat.
Exactly. No, I actually think that you could even arrive at launch control systems that, unintentionally, because you're trying to minimize this. You're trying to minimize this. You find a new novel way to, like, you know, control the way the power is applied to the rear via the chain. Every component gets looked at, and then you basically end up what you had when you just had a simple sensor on the wheel and
right,
feedback back
right.
to the system. You know, but now there's no sensor on the wheel. There's no sensor on any rotating bits, and you're just, you know, using like the tension and the feedback, you know, whatever from the rest of the chassis. So yeah, that's the hard one, because I think this is a really good point that David Emmett made, which was that, you know, they banned Formula One traction control, and, like, you know, have you ever seen a Formula One car peel out at the start in like the last 5-6 years? They do not. They are totally glued to the freaking ground, and it's not the tires. It's just they have traction. They have launch control. It's just not not what was banned
last year. There was an effect.
And
from
this
the drivers,
is basically so you, you were just starting to say
that they made. They were basically
it doesn't actually save costs.
You know, the driver
it applies
was
to
having
almost
to drive
everything
more.
Here.
Now This, though, I've got to make my point of my whole stance that racing has the social responsibility to develop for our street bike stuff, right?
Yeah,
which I still somewhat believe. I really do. Mm-hmm. That and launch control and traction control, these are things that benefit Joe Schlub, 18-year-old kid that runs out and buys the leader bike and all of that. If he has some sort of electronic aid, huh?
And then flips it.
Right. Well, if he has all these electronic aids, it's going to be that much harder for him to do that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that one, yeah, sure. Okay, you might save some money somewhere on paper in the fantasy land that all the manufacturers are just going to fall in line and say, oh, you're right. We'll just have, no more throttle by wire and all of that business. It'll be, the real thing. Yeah, that would save money. But that's not what's going to happen. They will find the part where the technical guys forgot to put in a rule, or they will find a way to flat out cheat or whatever. And those things are going to cost money. But then on the other hand, I don't think that all that technology, because it's got to be secret, it's not going to trickle down to street bikes. So I think that one's dumb.
The launch control thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, it's, I think there's some riders that have really good launch control systems. Some small Spanish riders that have good launch control systems, and they really need them, and they probably will not be as competitive without them. So it's a big deal.
Do you think, real quick on that, when you make that comment, do you think that because Danny Pedrosa is so much lighter than a lot of these other guys, that his body weight is affecting the wheel spin and stuff?
I think he needs launch control.
Because of his body weight?
Yeah, because he's so light.
Yeah, I think that makes a certain amount of sense. And I'm just wondering, like I said, if it's because I agree.
And the thing is, he uses it for that. And he also needs it because I'm probably getting annoying saying this, but he's just not a very good passer, which means he needs to be close to the front at the start of the race. He doesn't make up 16 positions like some other riders can.
Right, exactly. He has to, if he's going to win the race, he has to win it right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. He has to be in the leading group, right from the start.
I agree.
The thing is, let's talk about this whole cost saving thing, because
okay,
I think that the thing that really has just been annoying is that we've had all these reactive rules year after year after year. This is the third year in a row where we had completely reactive rules, reactive to first the speeds were getting too fast, or I really don't know what the 990 to 800 story really was. I guess people have all sorts of conspiracy theories and whatever about five cylinder engines having a cylinder cut off of them, whatever. But yeah. Then the single tire rule and all this stuff, and it's so incredibly reactive. They're sweeping changes and they're being done in frickin' end of February middle of February, and these manufacturers already sunk all these R&D costs into these things, and
right.
That's where the real money is spent. The money isn't spent building these things; it's spent designing them,
building the very very first one.
That money's already been spent, so it's they're not saving. In fact, they're raising the costs for all these guys because they have to now do the same thing with different technology.
Sure.
And the bottom line is these guys are always going to try to go faster because they are not measuring themselves against other riders at test days because they only get one or two of those. They're anticipating that the other guy, they're comparing the results only to one thing, which is the data from last year. And they want to go faster than last year. And they're going to do whatever it takes to go faster than last year. Right? And
I
the guys
agree.
With the money are going to be able to actually sink it in there. And the guys who don't, the guys who actually need this help to
are
stay
going to
on
be at the back of the grid,
are going to have even harder time. I think that the 990s, that era, would have survived a lot easier through this time, through this financial difficult times, than this constant rule changing especially this late, there's only a month left before these bikes have to go out get built sure. out and go on the track, you know?
Right. And even though some of these rules are extended to like after Brno, which is, you know, after the midpoint of the season and all of that, after the summer break. So they're giving them some time. That still means they're going to be scrambling for a few months to do whatever it is to redesign things in order to make their five engines last eight races right, and stuff right. like that, you know, right. and that will take money. Yeah. If you wanted to say that, okay, we know that the main way to save money by making an engine last longer is going to be reducing revs and this and that, then put a rev limit on there, you know, but not that I necessarily always agree with that, but that's, it's sort of a more direct, less weasel wordy way of doing it. Does that make sense?
But again, that affects like power output. That does not affect
sure.
that these guys are going to be finding ways to go make faster laps. Right?
Right. I agree.
It's just the big thing that happened between 990s and 800s is that the corner speed got faster, which actually made the sport more dangerous.
Exactly. Because the crashes happen in the corners.
And they're much more violent. I think that, I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe this really will. But I mean, the bottom line is, I think that by they want to make sure that by 2010 season we get some more bikes on the grid. I just don't know who's going to be coming back.
That's the thing, and I mean, you're still looking at, you know, at a relatively, you know, if a company is a relative startup or relatively small or they just, you know, they're spending their money elsewhere, et cetera, like, you know, okay, BMW, Aprilia, Ilmor, they all fall into these different categories, you know, relatively small, a startup or they're spending their money somewhere else or whatever. You'd have to make it cheaper for them to come into MotoGP. And I don't think they're going to want to when, okay, it's like, okay, we've got this many bazillions of dollars that we're willing to spend to be at the back of the grid because Honda and Yamaha are up there spending more bazillions and have been doing it longer. And you know what I'm saying? I don't think that these rules are going to help bring more manufacturers to the table.
They're not. They've been making a lot of things complicated. So,
yeah. And that was always one of the beauty parts of the MotoGP rulebook was how thin it was.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that what really hurts is innovation, because innovation can sometimes actually make things cheaper, because somebody can come up with something that's like, hey, this is just a brilliant cheap solution, you know. A perfect example is Gary McCoy's riding style with the whole spinning up the tire. He completely changed the way people rode, and I think the way he rode was a little bit over the limit, but a lot of riders took a look at him and started riding more loosely and made better lap times, you know.
Right.
So
now, wasn't Gazza in the news recently? He's going to be in Superbikes, isn't he?
No, I think he's in Super Sport on the Triumph still, isn't he?
Super Sport on the Triumph still? Okay. I thought I saw his name pop up in the news recently, something different, but
that'd be awesome.
Sorry. Yes, we digress.
Lots of rule changes and I think that back in the 990 days, you had so much oodles of power that there were just many different, and there's so few rules on that you could probably come up with just simple but brilliant ideas, and that wouldn't necessarily be expensive. So some startup could actually come up with like some technical breakthrough that didn't cost millions and millions of dollars to develop, but was just a really damn good idea. And the power plant is very well understood. They're still trying to harness that power. Whereas now they're like trying to squeeze every little bit out of every, you know, liter of fuel and every revolution of the engine. So
that makes sense. It does. Also telling, when we didn't kind of get into detail, that the ban on launch control not only covers electronic but also hydraulic launch control systems.
Right. That's right. It does.
Now, does that mean that there's, you know, is there some loophole there that I don't know about, you know, what, that there's something else, you know, I don't know. When you say that these are reactionary rule changes, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And it's like the perfect prison, right? You build this perfect prison, and because prisoners are human beings and people and tend to be clever and thoughtful, and when they're in prison, they have a lot of time on their hands to think about stuff. They think of ways to escape from your prison. So then you have to react by doing something differently. And I think that the analogy is right there. That, you know, yeah. Okay, MotoGP comes up and they, you know, Carmelo sticks his finger in the dike for this thing, and then, you know, oh wow, you know, another hole appears.
Everybody's in solitary.
Yeah. Exactly. That's super solitary. You know. Yeah. But I don't know. It's a little bit of a shocker that it's this late in the season. It's more than a little bit of a shocker. I think it's distressing. And I also am so many of these things, it's just like, you know, do these people think, you know, have they not learned from what other sports have seen and experienced and all of that? I don't know. Just crazy.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many parallels between that and like what's been going on in the banking world and everything. I mean, people just have a very, very skewed perspective from these seats of power. And I'm not saying like, you know, Carmelo Spalletta is some kind of dictator, but he is so used to like, I'm going to do this to save the sport. I'm going to do this to save the sport, blah, blah, blah. You know, he thinks that, you know, that's what it takes. And he keeps meddling with the damn thing. And what it really takes is actually to somebody lay off the teams and just let them be.
You let nature take its course. I mean, if we totally let things just, you know, Darwinian evolution and all that take its course, it's going to boil down to, you know, Honda and Yamaha have the most money and can outspend everyone. But on the other hand, my own sort of devil's advocate thing that I got going on here, Ducati has a lot less money. Just a completely different company mindset,
mm-hmm.
that has enabled them to do very, very well on, I'm sure, a lot less money.
It kind of actually just is that the point I was making earlier about the brilliant ideas, the true innovations. You know, the reason why in 2007 Qatar that bike just kept accelerating past Rossi every time he got past Casey Stoner. That first race wasn't just the motor; it was also aerodynamics that the other manufacturers weren't really paying attention to as much, because they were like, "Well, speeds are going to be slower. You know, we're gonna. I mean, they did. I'm sure they did wind tunnel tests, but Ducati threw everything into the design of the fairings, and they changed the fairings during the season for different races, and you know, so I love that kind of stuff. That's so cool. It's like,
right,
you know,
right.
It's really
I like the one with the fairing had the holes in it. You talk about a low cost, yeah. Actually, maybe not low cost. Yeah, it's low cost to make the holes in it, but it's not necessarily low cost to determine that those holes are going to have a benefit.
Well, you know, so those guys like do wind tunnel testing, which is expensive stuff. But you know, computers are getting more and more powerful. There's a lot of computer models now that do a pretty decent job, so you don't even have to build a thing, and you already have a pretty good idea of how it's going to behave.
Yeah,
of course. Once you build it, it does. It's always, you're always like, oh shit, we forgot about this variable in physics. You know,
it's constant tweaking and tuning. Yeah. On the other hand, this whole reducing the costs and all of that. I mean, I got to think Formula One again, where we have the somewhat openness. Toyota has historically been spending the most money of any team, just stupid amounts of money, and they suck.
Right.
And I think Honda spends a lot of money, and well, they're gone.
Right,
and,
that's how much they spend.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily always the people with the most money have the most success, because that brings into the mindset of a company like Ducati that is so focused on racing. And like Honda used to be 40 or 50 odd years ago, before they got, you know, to be a behemoth. And I think, you know, Honda likes to think that they still have that uber racing heritage, but I think that on the other hand, they have gotten away from it, and they tend to be using money to keep their advantage. You're never gonna control the costs. I mean,
no, that's the thing, is you won't, and all this stuff is just, you know, it just means that people are gonna find, these manufacturers are gonna find different ways of getting.
Right.
They're still going to spend the money.
Yeah, exactly. If they have the money, they're going to spend it.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can see this at the club level, or at the even lower than that, the, you know, the amateur, I don't know, fairground racer guy you know, the guy that has more money to spend on his engine is the guy that wins.
Yeah, yeah, but you know what? I think the cheapest era of the four strokes was the 990s.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was the cheapest. That was a time when it was the cheapest to run a team. We had tons of privateer teams, cheaper than the
800s. Yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, but because previously I've had the two strokes, and if you want to talk about cheap, the two strokes are going to be way cheaper because they're, you know, almost at a developmental semi dead end.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I mean, the 250 thing is crazy as far as like a money saver because, you know, now you're going to have manufacturers that are going to have to fiddle around with all sorts of different things and
yeah,
it's just going to be a mess.
Yeah. Part of me is actually looking forward to what's going to happen with Moto 2, but yeah. But here's the thing is I don't think that manufacturers are throwing more money every year into racing. I mean, it's like maybe proportional to like inflation, yes, but not, they're not just like doubling their budget every year. So if that's really the case, right? Just imagine that like in 2003, you know, they kind of locked the formula down, which is 990s, you know, such and such brakes, this. Okay, so some set of technical rules, and they just leave them alone, right?
Right.
And because this whole controlling cost thing is like the most money that I think was spent in the last 10 years was when they had to invent the 800s, you know, when they had to go from the 990s to 800. That was when teams like Team KR took a real hit and eventually had to go away. And Kawasaki started sucking and basically pulled out this year because there was no point. You know, Suzuki had to give up a season of results pretty much because they were just trying to build something for the next era of motorcycles. That was the huge mistake. And the sad thing is that it's never going to be admitted. It's never going to be reverted, which would actually be a pretty smart thing right now. Because you know what? All those guys could immediately come up with a 990 bike right now.
Because you got gobs of power and you're just, yeah, exactly.
They already have them. I mean, they have the technology. You know, they could mount it on the new frames and they wouldn't be able to do that the same kind of corner speed because they'd be coming off the straightaway faster or whatever.
I agree. And I think it makes for better racing as well because the rider has to be more, you know, if you want a purist form of where it's the rider and the machine and all of that business, you know. I think that the rider is more involved in that kind of motorcycle because there's less electronics.
Yeah. I mean, I think the electronics would stay because they're already here.
Sure.
You know, when I'm going to go backwards unless the rules demand it. But I really think that if they actually like admitted, you know, it was a mistake to go to 800s, the smart thing would be to go to the 990 and just let them loose. Let them go.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
I agree. I really do. Because in a lot of ways, I think, this might be a bit just making stuff up, but it's once you get past a leader, you're starting to get into the like kind of, you know, stupid big realm of engines. You know, you don't see a lot of people like Hayabusa's on. You know, they tend to be drag bikes rather than road course bikes. You don't see a lot of people doing track days on them, that sort of thing, on the big 1300s.
Right.
Simply because Rockets. You know, you get they're getting to be so heavy and everything else that there's a disadvantage, and so it was maybe, you know, I might be, like I said, a little bit just making stuff up here, but that roughly 1,000 cc limit is kind of a, at least right now, the best place to be as far as just monstrous power
on these particular tracks,
maneuverability
on these particular tracks, which were designed kind of around,
right?
You know, I mean, a lot of these tracks are not that old; they're, you know, 10, 15 years old. So everything kind of grew up together, and then there were big changes, and then money had to be thrown at the problem. So yeah, I mean,
that theory makes a certain amount of sense. And I do want to say that I want to real quick. I was going down one road where it's not always how much money you spend that dictates where you win, and then all of a sudden I went down the other road where it's saying whoever spends the most money wins. But It kind of depends on where you're spending that money at and what your mindset is.
Right. So I mean, you've got Yamaha's spending a lot of money on Valentino Rossi. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you cut Valentino Rossi out, you could probably run like 4 privateer teams on that guy's salary. So. But exactly. You're not going to cut him out because
he wins races and championships.
Championships.
Right? Make him go get his salary off endorsements. Okay. Well.
So speaking of Valentino Rossi.
Speaking of Valentino Rossi, exactly. I was just going to say, what's Valentino the other Rossi? Thing we were going to talk about?
There was this funny press release. I mean, he turned 30, which is like, I'm just like, you know, I remember when I turned 30, I was like, oh, you know, my life is I'm no longer a kid, and people are starting to refer to me as a man. It was like, I was like, damn, this is ridiculous.
And that's funny. 30 never bothered me in the slightest. I think 40 gave me a couple of moments.
Right, but, right, right. But yeah. That, when you're 40 plus and you look back at a guy who's turning 30 and there's all these people who are talking about him turning 30, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, I know exactly. But, yeah. Wow, but, 30.
But there were some funny comments. I really, really loved this one. I have a friend who's Italian who read this in Italian, said it was much funnier in Italian. Unfortunately, I don't have the Italian version, and I don't speak Italian, but it's Aldo Giudi, who is the designer of Rossi's helmets. Here's what he was. I just love this. So basically, they had all these people that know Rossi or are fans of his and are well-known, you know, write little wishes to him, like La Vita Bravio and Aspaletta and all those guys, Colin Edwards.
Tom Cruise,
I don't know why, but whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, Aldo Giudi was a really good one. He says, Cattolica, August 1996, 2 p.m., very hot. I'm traveling by motorbike on a deserted road toward the sea when a small and colorful outline appears in an intersection ahead, going very fast. A young boy on a scooter closes the corner, accentuates the bend, runs around the pavement, straightens up, and pulls a wheelie. He holds the wheelie on the aqua green zip for more than 200 meters, still on the gas. I accelerate and catch him. The boy lets go of the left handlebar and lifts the left hand in the sign of victory. I recognize him and follow him. Finally, he lowers the wheel, and with his feet on the footrest, he throws embraces and salutes all around the road to his imaginary fans. He notices me right beside him and smiles. Happy birthday, Valley. That is such a like hilarious scene. I mean, I'm not sure if it's true, but it's just... Fits that guy, I mean, Valentino Rossi, so well. Like, just riding around and practicing his bows and congratulations for victory. You know, like
pulling a long wheelie on a scooter.
It's great.
Yeah,
totally hilarious. And the other one I wanted to mention was just like this. Really, just so James Toseland. He's like, 30 is a big milestone for a racer because even though you're not really old as a person, you're starting to be one of the older ones in professional racing, and you start to feel that you can't go on forever. I don't think it's a problem for Valentino, however. He seems to still feel 25. As long as that continues, he'll be just fine. Okay, how old is James Toseland? He's like 27, I think? 28?
27, 28, someone there. Yeah. Almost 30-ish. Yeah.
This guy is so dry, dude. What the?
I know.
You know, I don't know. His music like doesn't do anything for me, and I love to see him banging bikes every once in a while like he does, but in general, just like no personality.
Yeah, did you see the thing where Colin Edwards basically says that they no longer talk at all?
Toseland. Wonder Boy, or whatever he called him.
Yeah, over the crew chief incident. Yeah. We're digressing, but that was also popped up in the news. One of the stories that came up. And I think that was Crash.net, which I always... Crash.net's a bit of the National Enquirer, let's see, for our UK fans, you know, tabloid newspaper.
The Star.
Suspicious sources. I think, at least. I liked Kenny Roberts saying, Valentino, when I first saw you ride at the ranch in Barcelona, I thought Kevin Schwantz was tall and skinny. You were very right. Impressive then as you are now. So I thought that one was kind of cool.
That is awesome.
But yeah, there's some good stuff. And Reno Salucci says, am I asking too much if I ask for 30 more years of excitement? He says, well, I can live with half.
Awesome. Awesome.
But yeah, that is kind of cool. And it is, you know, he's a relatively speaking, one of grand old men, the seniors or whatever of the, MotoGP paddock.
Well, you know, with Hopper and Melandri not having a ride, although the Melandri thing is still bubbling.
I was going to say, have you heard about the Dornasecchi? But yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just weird.
Yeah. But those guys aren't that old. How old is Hopper?
No, I'm saying those guys are younger.
Yeah.
Than leaving and they're getting replaced by, you know, like Setes. I think the average age may have actually gone up.
Yeah, I mean, what is Sete, like 43 or something? You know? There's hope for you, Jules, still. Fix your Ducati. Yeah, actually, though, that would be interesting. What is the average age of the riders on the grid now that we've lost Marco and Hopper, now that we've gained Sete, which I am still looking forward to seeing Sete Giovinazzi on the grid.
It's going
to
be great.
I just wonder, is Valentino going to divert some of his mental attentions from Casey Stoner? You know, got to get inside Casey Stoner's head. Is he going to just, you know, divert 10% of that to, you know, I'm just going to screw around with Sete for old time's sake, you know, or what?
I think it'd be funny, but I think that the way he can screw with Giovinazzi the most, actually, this probably work with Biaggi more, but is to just completely ignore him, which actually works because he has to, because he has to concentrate on Stoner.
Yeah, that might be true. And you're right, though, that it would work on Biaggi more.
Yeah.
Although Sete is quite the, egotist, glory hound kind of guy. Yeah,
of course.
I wonder, is his hair? Have you seen photos of him with it? Is his hair still, you know, good?
You know what? I saw one photo of him when he didn't have a mullet, but somebody told me that he had a tied or something. So I don't know.
Okay, because I saw something where he was like skiing, but you couldn't really tell. Yeah, and we will have the delicious Sete's girlfriend shots. Those are always entertaining.
Right.
Yes. So. All right. Anything else, other stuff that came up that we want to mention? Yeah, or?
Just a minor thing that I wanted to say, which is Polacy nareszcie będą mieli MotoGP na żywo i po polsku na kanale Sport Club. Ogłoszone to było w czasie zjazdu motorsportowego w Warszawie, na której podobno był Lawrence Caprossi. Nie słyszałem jeszcze, kto będzie komentował. There.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Is that all pronounced right?
Because
I have no idea.
Yeah, so. MotoGP is getting is coming to Poland. It's a pretty big deal. So
excellent.
I mean, not as a race, but basically they're going to be showing it instead of Eurosport. They're going to have Polish announcers announcing it and stuff. So pretty cool.
And I have to. I'm ashamed to admit I didn't even recognize that as Polish. So.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Good for you, Jules. And I know that we have some listeners in Poland, so hopefully, you know, yeah, good. Yeah. Cool deal. Well, cool. Other than that, I think that probably about covers it for this week. I'm sure we missed some stuff, and we'll try to catch up with it on next week. And I sprung on you. I don't think I even mentioned to you that we were doing the contest for the Fast App.
Right,
MotoGP timing. Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, but that's kind of cool.
I heard it on the show.
Yeah, it's always a surprise that way. And so if you out there, listeners, have not, if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch that is capable of getting the apps from the iTunes App Store, we're doing a contest for Adam Kress's cool little iPhone application that will bring the live timing. So, I mean, that'd actually be super handy. To be able to just have that on your phone or iPod rather than, you know, having to lug around a laptop.
Right, right. And now he should make a BlackBerry version.
A BlackBerry version for Jules, yes. Right. So, but right on. I guess that about does it. So we'll hopefully find some good stuff to talk about next week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right, man.
All right.
Ciao.
Ciao. That's going to do it for today. Appreciate you downloading the show. Thanks very much for listening to the entire thing. Like I said, there was a bit of a prep issue on my side of things. I just simply have not had time. I've been dealing with so much stuff at work, quite a bit of stuff in my personal life and all of that, and it's just things have to fall through the cracks. So if you happen to be an Open Directory expert or even an LDAP expert, let me know, because I have some problems going on with some macOS 10 servers running Open Directory, and I can't seem to fix them. And, maybe you can help me out. But other than that, check out those links that I mentioned earlier on the show. We're going to put them up on MotoGPOD.com. We always like having you guys listen. We always like hearing you from you in email, even if we may not answer promptly. Really, really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. And we will talk to you next week. Oh, geez, got the tape in there backwards here. One more time. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.